You're not going to get a lot of this stuff anywhere else. That is why we say these are the stories that you need to know about today.
What Xi Jinping was saying was that China's rising and President Trump was leading a failing society.
The Russians can't allow the Europeans to get off scot-free while the Ukrainians do the Europeans' dirty work.
There's nothing Europe can do to defend itself. This is my way of telling the Europeans, shut up. You will lose. You've got nothing.
We're going to bring you all of that and also an interview with Ray McGovern. Ray McGovern is a CIA analyst who used to brief the American presidents every morning. We'll have all that right here. It's time for the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and you are one of the millions of people who are watching us in five different languages every single week, and I am so grateful that you are there and so grateful for your input. We are paying attention to you. The reaction regarding the much ballyhooed summit in China between Mr. Xi and Mr. Trump is still coming in. The winner, though, is China. Yep, Mr. Trump certainly deserves a participation award. I mean, it was important for him to be there. But officially, anyway, he really didn't get anything from the Chinese. Now, were there some great moments? Oh, yeah. Maybe not so much from a substantive point of view, but there were certainly plenty of great media moments that were put on display. Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi's virtues were on display, or some would ask, maybe lack thereof. For example, while visiting a historic garden, President Trump interrupted the tour, seeming to look for a headline for himself that he could grab. He asked for assurance from Mr. Xi that he was the only person, the only president who had actually been to this very special place. Mr. Xi made Trump feel important. But he did tell him that others had been there in the past, including the president of Russia, Mr. Putin. So listen to it yourself. Here's how the microphones captured this exchange.
Yes. I passed the document from other countries, from other countries, presidents and prime ministers. Does he bring
that?
In the past, we never had a Higgins. Yeah.
I think Mr. Xi was too polite to disappoint Mr. Trump, but as it turns out, the garden had been visited by at least two other U.S. presidents before Mr. Trump. Mr. Nixon had been there with Mao, and President Trump had been there with Xi in the past. Then there was the so-called summit, media availability, as it's called, where the two leaders sit side by side. Look at this. Look at this. If a picture is worth a million words, then this one speaks like 2 million words, right? Look at Mr. Trump's demeanor. Look at his posture. Look how hunched down he is. Look at his shoulders, rounded, maybe tired. Remember, Trump is a lot taller than Xi, yet it's Xi here that looks like he's at attention. He looks to be more present, and a lot of people notice that. So, look, this Xi-Trump meetings may have been described best this way. It was where China told the United States very clearly, we will respect you, we will work with you, but we are not subservient to you, and you will no longer be telling us what to do. China can say that with some confidence because it, like in the past 5 months or so, it has kind of beaten Mr. Trump, both at home, I mean in the United States and abroad. At home, they beat him by turning the tables on his tariffs. And now is when we're really seeing it. You could call it the Walmart effect. You know, in the United States, one of the most well-known sayings is, everybody uses this as a joke, attention Walmart shoppers. Let me tell you, Walmart shoppers are paying attention to prices. You see, China used to produce quality stuff inexpensively for us Americans. It was great going to a Walmart. You could find just about anything at a Walmart. Anything you could possibly want. And usually it's like dirt cheap. You buy two or three of them, throw one away, give them away. Not anymore. American consumers, as well as farmers and ranchers, they've been hit hard by China's retaliatory measures against Trump's tariffs. And this retaliation has sent inflation levels to new heights, as I reported to you last week. Then there's Iran. Look, Iran is a strategic loss so far for the United States. There's no doubt about it. And I'm going to tell you why these trains have something to do with it, something to do with China. It's becoming increasingly clear that Iran was secretly prepared for and more than ready for a fight with the United States, expecting the attack that came. The reason it was so ready was it got help from China. And how? Look at this railroad bridge from China to Tehran. Most of the world doesn't even know about this. They don't even know it existed. It was built by China about a year ago, before the war. It connects the two countries and it helps them avoid sanctions. This railroad, look at this thing. It's fast, it's efficient, and it shows China's commitment to Iran, which is why it didn't waver during this summit. Goods that used to take months by sea to get from one place to another now arrive in 15 days without having to be stopped along the way by the U.S. Navy to ask questions. So, yes, this seems to have been, fair to say, a strong showing by China. And you know how I know that China did well? I check to see what the neocons are saying. You know, the usual China critics and the pro-West talking heads, to see what they were saying. I'll give you an example. See this guy right here on camera? See that guy? His name is Gordon Cheng. Nice guy. I used to talk to him all the time. I know him because when I worked at CNN, he's the guy they always told me to talk to. He was kind of forced on me, right? He's the guy that I had to talk to about all things related to China. He rarely had anything good to say about Beijing. He hates China. This time, though, I want you to listen how even he describes China's seeming dominance in these Trump meetings between the two leaders. Take a listen.
On Thursday, in front of President Trump and in front of the cameras, he actually referred to the Thucydides trap. That's a reference to the Peloponnesian Wars, where you had a rising power challenge a declining ruling hegemon. And so what Xi Jinping was saying was that China's rising and President Trump was leading a failing society. But it got even worse than that, because Xi Jinping also referred to the, quote, new era. That's Xi Jinping speak for the time when China rules the world and where the U.S. is irrelevant. So this was just, to me, I hadn't heard a Chinese leader say those things or anything like that to an American president. And it shows you that deterrence is breaking down and that Xi Jinping is willing to insult the American president to his face.
Now let's talk about another superpower. Let's talk about Russia. And I need to back off a little bit on something I said recently. And in fact, you've heard me say this many times. I've always talked about how Russia has no interest in attacking Europe. Why? There's nothing in Europe that Russia needs. I mean, just think about it, right? Look at a map. Russia dwarfs every country in Europe. It's almost twice the size of the entire continent, all the countries put together. And Russia has more timber, it has more rare earth minerals, it has certainly more hydrocarbons, it has a higher GDP, really just about more of everything. In fact, Russia would probably prefer simply to be left alone by the Europeans. Sure, it would love for the Europeans to once again continue buying its efficient and inexpensive fuel, but even if they don't, Russia's like, okay, look, fine, just leave us alone. We'll sell it to somebody else. In fact, we're already selling it to China and India and Indonesia and a zillion other countries. So no problem, right? But there is a problem. There is a problem. And you know what the problem is? Europe's contempt for Russia. It is so visceral, so extreme, that they almost seem to be begging for a fight with Russia. Why? Look at what people are talking about here in Moscow over the weekend to prove this. These images, they show what it looks like after drones hit civilian targets, and there's a lot of this going on. Look at these pictures, right? Drones rain down, about 1,000 of them, on Russian civilian targets. Three people were killed in Greater Moscow. At least one other person was killed outside the capital. Russians are having lots of sleepless nights. I know, they were all telling me about it. I was playing golf with some friends this weekend. They were all talking about the same thing, all these drones, how angry they are. Explosions are heard as the country's Russia's air defense system is working overtime, knocking down these 1,000 drones that came in, but some got through. Look, Russians, the people of Russia, now know where these drones are coming from, and they know it's not Ukraine. It used to not be this way, but it is now. Russians, the population, is convinced that the real attackers of their cities, their apartment buildings, are Europeans. The drones are coming from NATO. Why do they believe that? Because we all know now that NATO provides the weaponry and the funding and the training and the satellite support and the intel and the targeting data and the components for all of these attacks on Russian cities. Ukraine is just a tool, really. The real attackers, they live in London and Berlin and in Paris and in Warsaw. Now, how much of, here's the question, how much of this can the Russian government actually take? More and more military experts, like combat veteran Daniel Davis, who I follow, is saying, or fearing, not much.
We have deluded ourselves into thinking that we have all the escalation cards and that therefore Russia will never do anything and we're free to play in their background and blow stuff up and ha ha, look at them. But what if the Russian side says, we're not playing that game anymore, and now then it's your turn to start sweating? We just think it's another saber to rattle. And that they'll never do that because they know we have all these nuclear weapons and we would retaliate. And so that certainty will keep them from doing anything. But now then, there are those in Russia that are thinking differently. They're saying, you know what? You're not the only one that can go down that path. And if you think we would never do it, then you may be shocked.
Yeah, like Karaganov, who was on this show recently, who said something similar. Now, Davis points out that it was NATO that provoked the war in Ukraine by removing a government in Ukraine that was friendly with Moscow and replacing it with one that was not friendly with Moscow, in fact, anti-Russia. Then NATO armed that government with hundreds of billions of dollars so that it could attack the Donbass region. And when the Russians responded with what they call their special military operation, NATO doubled down with more money and more weaponry. But despite all of this, Russia's military has not been set back. It has continued to win the war of attrition along the front lines, which may be why NATO has now chosen to kind of abandon the front line and try a different approach. Rather than sending its money and its arms to Ukraine to fight in the trenches, front lines, it's allowing it, maybe even instructing it, to just go ahead and hit Russia, strike at Russia, hit Russia's civilian targets. This weekend, it was stepped up and on full display again, as I showed you. Headlines around the world are telling it. The weapons are hitting Russian civilians, hitting apartment buildings, closing down airports more frequently, hitting railway lines, and they're also hitting Russia's oil facilities. By the way, at a time when they themselves, the Europeans, are in most need of Russia's fuel. So it's kind of weird that they would be doing that, right? So here's the question. Here's the question that needs to be asked. Is Russia not responding because it can't? Maybe Russia's too weak. Maybe Putin's weak. Does it not have the wherewithal to respond? What is it? Here is military analyst Scott Ritter with his take over the weekend.
The Russians just showed the other day that they can saturate Ukraine's airspace, 1,500 launched in a day. They can expand that launch capacity. They can darken the skies of Europe, and Europe has no air defense. I'll just say that one more time. Europe has no air defense. They've been, you know, bankrolling 700 a day. So in 10 days, that's 7,000. In a month, that's 21,000. It's now been a couple years. So the Russians will be able to sustain a 3,000 drone a day attack against a continent that can't defend itself for several months, meaning they will literally flatten everything. There's nothing Europe can do. Now we bring to bear the fact that the Oreshnik and other long-range missiles, because the United States, in our stupidity, have withdrawn from the INF Treaty, and now the Russians have taken action. It's not just the Oreshnik they have. They have an Oreshnik 2.0 that nobody's talking right now, which is an improvement on the Oreshnik. They have the Iskander K, which is a long-range cruise missile variant of the Iskander missile. So Russia will be able to fire hundreds of these a day into strategic targets, aircraft, bunkers, etc. Europe is defenseless. There's nothing Europe can do to defend itself. This is my way of telling the Europeans, shut up. You will lose. You've got nothing.
So is Russia planning to respond? There seems to be a lot of chatter about that, a lot of palaver about that. A lot of people are saying, is Russia getting ready to do something? Because, you know, a big dog after a while can only take so much for a little yapping dog, right? Eventually, the big dog's going to bite back. Ritter's not the only person saying these things, by the way. There's other geopolitical big thinkers who are weighing in on what's happening in Russia. And their conclusion is pretty much similar to what Mr. Ritter says. What other superpower, you have to ask yourself this, what other superpower would allow its territory to be attacked repeatedly, its bridges blown up, its generals assassinated, right? What other superpower would allow stuff like that? What other superpower would allow another country to take over one of its neighbors and weaponize it against it, as NATO did in Ukraine? Here's John Mearsheimer.
The argument is that the Russians just can't allow this to continue. The Russians can't allow the Europeans to get off scot-free while the Ukrainians do the Europeans' dirty work. So the Karaganov argument is that what we have to do is we have to send a very clear signal to the Europeans that this has to cease, that they cannot continue to use Ukraine as a battering ram against Russia. If these Europeans think that they can allow the Ukrainians to knock Russia out of the ranks of the great powers with this strategy, they're delusional. We're not going to let this happen. That's the argument. So anyway, what Karaganov says should first be done is that countries in Europe that support the Ukrainians should be struck with conventional weapons.
You know, what's funny about this is Russian officials, including Mr. Putin, are now being asked these questions. Mr. Peskov was just asked recently. I think we're going to have that and we're going to play it for you after the break. What good is it to be a nuclear power if people keep hitting you all the time and you don't respond? These are very serious questions that are being asked of the Russian government these days. And we're going to be talking to somebody who knows as much about the Russian government as anyone. He's an analyst. He used to work at the CIA. In fact, Ray McGovern used to be a guy who would brief the president of the United States every single morning. That's how important he was in the CIA. And he's going to be joining us to talk about this situation when we come back. Do not go away. We are so fortunate to be joined by Ray McGovern. He's a former CIA analyst. He used to brief the presidents of the United States. He also speaks fluent Russian, interestingly enough. So he knows a little bit about Russia geopolitics. So he's the perfect guy to be talking about what's going on right now. Given this situation where I said a little while ago, Russia's like a big dog and a yapping dog keeps biting him, and the big dog just kind of turns his head and doesn't mess with him. But at some point, the big dog is going to bite back. The question is when. A lot of your colleagues are saying it's very soon. What do you think of this, Ray?
I think that we're very fortunate in having such a cautious, perspicacious person as Vladimir Putin in office. He's not going to be sucked into something that would be most dangerous. His priority, as has been clear all along, is to make sure that a president so volatile and so unpredictable as Trump, with his fingers on the nuclear codes will not be tempted or feel himself justified to use those codes if they give them to him. That's the power. That's the paramount consideration here. And so why would the Russians, winning as they are in Ukraine, why would they risk doing what some of those fiery Europeans and the Ukrainians want? And that is create such a situation as the U.S. might be tempted to go in with both feet. It doesn't fit. In other words, I see Putin bombing and missiling the hell out of these production facilities for drones and other things in Ukraine. I don't see any reason why he would take these, well, I used to say pinpricks. They're a little bit more dangerous now. There were, what, three people killed and 18
and a thousand drones, 1,000 drones this weekend. Yeah.
Yeah, the interesting thing, Rick, is that the Russian air defenses are pretty capable.
Yes.
Three people killed, 18 wounded. That's bad, but the Ukrainians have no air defenses.
Well, let me tell you why there seems to be, I guess I could say, added pressure on Mr. Putin and his government. In fact, here's a reporter asking Peskov this question. I'll let him phrase it for us. Take a listen.
Sure. The question arises, I think, inevitably. But we have these powerful bombs, so what? It turns out you can nibble and bite a nuclear power.
But you cannot threaten a nuclear power. You cannot threaten its existence. This allows us to be confident about it. And it is the basis of nuclear deterrence. Nuclear deterrence is an integral part and the cornerstone of our national security as a whole.
You know, I played golf this weekend up in Pestovo. You probably know it's a great course. And all my friends out there, you know, guys are always talking when they're out playing golf. They're angry. I get a sense that a lot of the Russians are really starting to get just fed up because they know this is not a war with Ukraine. They feel not so much against the United States. For some reason, they don't seem to want to hold a grudge against us as Americans. They are angry at the Europeans. They feel like those 1,000 drones all came directly from either Berlin or London or Warsaw or Paris. That's how they feel. And they're asking their government to do something about it.
Yeah, not directly, right?
You mean right, the technology? Of course. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Yeah.
So that was Paul Zarubin, as you know, Putin's favorite journalist, talking to Peskov. Now, Putin himself was asked that question right after the Victory Day parade at that interesting press conference. Yeah. And the same fellow, Zarubin, said, now, President Putin, you know, these long-range drone strikes, they've gotten as far as Yekaterinburg, you know. What are you going to do about that? And I don't know if you remember what Putin said, because it wasn't very memorable, because he dodged the question to say anything about it, okay? Yeah. Now, that's calculated ambiguity. He can let Medvedev, he can let Karaganov, he can let all these other guys, you know, spew these warnings.
Yeah.
He's not going to join that. He's going to say, look, we're doing real well, which they are. And so, you know, the cost-benefit analysis that I do as an old Kremlinologist, I don't think worth the cost of, you know, just alienating or creating a situation where Trump might be tempted to do something really stupid and actually act under Article 5 and, you know, come then it would all be out of proportion. The proportion now is pinpricks, more people killed. But the Russians have the air defenses to contend with this, and they are obliterating, pardon the term, Ukrainian manufacturing, drone manufacturing stuff. And so it requires patience. But, you know, Putin is cool hand Luke. I mean, you're not going to get him to do it. You're not going to provoke him to do something that he might later regret, and the stakes are so high when you have an unpredictable guy with his fingers on the nuclear codes. I compliment Putin on that, because I know isn't a lot of pressure, but, you know, he's shown that they can win. They are winning. They're going to win this year in Ukraine. So meanwhile, can they put up with this stuff? In my view, they can. I see Putin going to China, right? Tomorrow he's going. Yeah. They'll be talking Wednesday. I think that would be key. When we look at that joint communique, now, there was no joint communique when Trump was there.
Right.
There were two different interpretations of what happened. But this time it's going to be a joint communique. There's precedent for Putin talking to Xi Jinping and saying, look, we may be forced to do something a little bit more aggressive, as they did before the invasion of Ukraine. Yeah, people forget, Putin was up in Beijing on the 4th of February 2022, 20 days before the invasion. And, you know, he was there ostensibly to open the Winter Olympics. But it's clear to me that he didn't want to go invading Ukraine without having a big brother on board. And so as I see it, he said, look, you know, you're not going to like this because you're a big Westphalia guy and you don't like people interrupting you. But look, it's come to this, blah, 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 blah. We're going to have to invade Ukraine. What do you think? And this is no joke. I think what she said was, you mean after the Winter Olympics are over, right? Putin goes, whew, okay.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
over on the 20th.
I could do
on
that.
The 24th. On the 20th, they're over. Okay. On the 21st, the Lugansk and Donetsk declare independence, want to join Russia and the Duma. And so on the 24th, you have the invasion. Now, there is a fallacy, post hoc ergo propter hoc. Just because something happens after something doesn't mean it happened because of something.
Yeah,
but,
no, right,
you know,
yeah.
The Chinese did change their rhetoric. They said, look, Westphalia is interesting, but when people have core interests like we do in Taiwan, like the Russians do in Ukraine, well, then you can, in effect, suspend Westphalia for as long as necessary. That's what they said in reality. Their rhetoric changed for the next 3 months. It was no more Westphalia. It was all about protecting core interests. And, you know, Rick, but everybody needs to be reminded that the Russians and the Chinese are together as never before.
Yes.
It'll be really interesting what comes out of Beijing.
Yeah.
As Putin departs on Wednesday.
Yeah, it's fascinating what you just said. I hadn't thought of that, which is why, once again, you have proven that you are much smarter than I am. The idea that Putin is suddenly making this trip to Beijing to talk to Mr. Xi at the same time when all the whispers around Moscow and around the world are, okay, winter's over and Russia's about to make a large move against their enemies, whatever those enemies are, Ukraine, Europe, whatever the hell. And you're saying the reason he's going there is to give a heads up to Mr. Xi to say, look, we're about to do something we got to do. I wanted to give you a heads up. And that's what you're saying is about to happen, which I hadn't thought of.
Yeah, it's really more general comparing notes and getting Xi's reaction to these courses of action. I know that there will be a major ground offensive in Ukraine this spring. I rule out any major missile attack on the rest of Europe. I think that, as I say, cost-benefit would persuade Putin, look, there's no percentage in that. We can win this thing by ourselves, and we can destroy those factories right within Ukraine. And I'll tell Xi that. But in case we have to go farther, we want to make sure that he knows what our needs are.
But if the Europeans are providing the weapons, providing the money, providing the intel, providing the components, providing the missile guidance, I mean, how do you stop that unless you do something to Europe to make them stop that?
You stop it by a comprehensive air defense system. Now, as I tried to say before, that's the difference. The Ukrainians ain't got one. The Russians do. So what were there, 1,000 or more of these drones just the other day? And what, 3 people were killed? Well, that's really too bad.
Of course.
18 wounded. Hello. Russians can defend against this and keep this threat into manageable, proportional limits. And you know, the notion that a cautious person like Vladimir Putin would go off and do something really strange and dangerous in attacking a NATO nation when he doesn't really have to,
yeah,
well, that goes beyond me. You know, a lot of my colleagues disagree, of course,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I've been an outsider before. You know, I almost enjoy it.
No, I listened to you talk to Danny Davis, and you and Scott Ritter have different points of view on this. Scott seems to think that, the Europe has crossed the red line, and the Russians know that, and they're about to act on that red line. A la Karaganov and others. You don't think that's the case. You truly believe that cooler heads are going to prevail, and we're not going to do something like the United States just did in Iran and is now regretting.
Karaganov is scary, as you know.
Yeah, he sat right here. I had him on the show. Yeah.
Yeah, I know you did. And so did Glenn Deason and others.
Yeah.
My God, you know, in Russian history, there used to be Westerners and Slavophiles, okay? He's kind of a Westerner with his pretty suit and tie and all that kind of stuff. And he's sort of effete. And he's a Westerner who draws from the worst of the Slavophiles and saying, you know, we're Russia. We're going to cream the rest of the world. Well, you know, I think that Putin, looking at this, says, well, he's going to say this anyway. I'm not going to stop him from saying this, but maybe there's benefit in this because he has scared the hell out of a lot of people, including some of my colleagues, including Glenn Deason and others. And that's all to the good. You can't just go with Medvedev scaring the hell out of him. You have to have some other people too. Karaganov is elected. Now, the other thing is that the Russians, as I think you already alluded to, are very careful to distinguish the Europeans from the United States.
Yes.
Even Medvedev, when he rants and raves about Ukraine, last paragraph is always, but the United States, we believe, is sincere in trying to get this thing finished and over with, okay? Now, they'd like to help. We don't need any help right now, but, you know, it's really a good thing that the United States is sincere. My God, the Europeans not sincere at all. So there is this, and again, it goes back, this sounds simplistic, but when a guy is so deranged, if you will, when a guy is so unpredictable and volatile as Trump, I mean, if I'm a statesman, I'm going to do everything I can to massage his ego.
Yeah, like she just did. Like she just did.
Yeah. Yeah. When I tell Ushakov, you know, hey, in the readout, make sure you put right up front that way to go in dodging that bullet, Mr. Trump. And we really value your wife's contributions to repatriating children and that and all that stuff. And then wait till the third paragraph to say this was completely unacceptable. Совсем неприемлемый to restart the war against Iran. And worse still, think about putting ground troops in there. I have more hope now that Trump has learned a whole lot. And even though he is totally unpredictable, and even though Netanyahu has some kind of hold on Trump and makes it really, really difficult to predict things, I think that the Iranians are smart enough. After all, most people don't know this, but Arachi, the foreign minister.
Yeah, I interviewed him.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I was pleased that you interviewed me, the likes of me.
But you're at the top of my list. What are you talking about?
So he's at the BRICS meeting, right? Now, what does he say? He said, you know, the United States has reached out several times to us. They'd like to have some sort of talks. There were two other points he made. He said Iran would welcome offers for help from China. As a matter of fact, what Iran has just done is name the Speaker of our parliament to be special representative to China. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the same guy who used to be special representative to talks with the likes of the Vice President and Witkoff and
Jared,
the other guy.
Jared Kushner, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, this is big. So you have at the same meeting, the BRICS meeting, Arachi saying these things, and you have Lavrov, Foreign Minister Lavrov, saying, yeah, you know, the Pakistanis can help too. And yeah, they're really eager to help, and they can help. So, you know, Trump doesn't have to do this. And I think the other factor is his military has to be sensible enough to say, ground invasion, we can't do it.
Yeah.
We can obliterate some more bridges and, you know, but they're going to retaliate and there'll be nothing left at all of our bases or of the United Arab Emirates. They'll be all gone. So yeah. You want to do that? Okay.
Let me ask you about Russia's military capability. There's a lot of talk about that since the special operation began. It seems like it's been fortified, gotten bigger, stronger. They're making more weapons. Then there are those in the West that say Russia's on its last leg. It can barely do what it's doing. Who's telling the truth here? Or what's your read? What's your sense of it?
Well, that's the same question I asked my good friend Scott Ritter in one of these programs about a week ago.
Yeah.
And his answer was very interesting because it really goes back to, let's say, 2016, when the that meeting in St. Petersburg, the economic leaders meeting there that they have in June almost every year.
Spief.
Putin took aside some Western journalists and he said, look, there were about 12 of them. And I have the tape. It's amazing. He says, look, I take advantage of your attendance here at this meeting to just tell you, look, I know that you're not gonna report this to your editors. You probably won't even tell them what we said here. But here's the line. And he says, you guys, the United States will not cooperate. So they have forced us to do other things other than terribly expensive ABM systems that don't work. And we have these things under, I can't tell you what they are yet, but they're coming in and you just got to be ready for that. 2 years later, at the State of the Union address, he said, he's got a show and tell. He's got six of these things. Videos show, whoa, this one will do this. This one goes around the South Pole. Yeah. This one goes on. So now they're online, for God's sake. Now, it can be said, and Scott knows a lot more than I do about this, but it can be said that when Trump advertises or pretends that U.S. is the sole superpower in the world, that's the BS. It isn't the case. The Russians outstrip us both in conventional and in strategic weaponry. That's the first. You know, I've been watching this for six decades, right? That's the first time.
You must
this
have been. So you know what? You, of all people, maybe you weren't, must have been shocked when you saw the lowly performance of the THAAD and the Patriot missile system in the Persian Gulf states, because that was supposed to be the creme de la creme. I mean, look what we got. We could now build a shield around any country, South Korea, Japan, wherever. It didn't do so well, you know? Not at all. Understatement.
Yeah, think about being a South Korean or a Japanese person. You know, you say, well, you know, not only do we not have enough of these THAADs or Patriots, but God, they don't work? Why is that? You know, the military experts that I rely on have been telling me for years that the Patriots could not defeat things like hypersonic missiles, neither could THAAD. And that's been proven right by this latest conflict. And the worst thing, of course, from the Israeli point of view, is they have no defense against Iranian hypersonic missiles. And Iranian doesn't have only 18% left, like Trump said. They have about 70 to 75% of those things left, like the CIA, for once being honest, said. So, you know, that's one thing that persuades me that if it can get through to Trump, that look, this is a no-win situation. They'll put enough They'll put enough lipstick on this pig of defeat to let you say, well, you prevented Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Yeah. Well, Putin at that presser after the Victory Day celebration said, you know, the Iranians say that they're not working on a nuclear weapon, and the IAEA has been all over that place, and they say there's no indication they're working on a nuclear weapon. Like, well, and we know, but the American people don't know.
No. I watched.
That can work to the advantage, Rick, because Trump is able to say, well, look, I prevented it from, look, they signed this paper. They're not going to get a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
In my view, even though the North Korean example has been advertised as something Iran has to do now, I don't buy that. There is a fatwa against it. I think if they do decide to reverse that fatwa, that we'll know about that. My Iranian friends tell me that it will have to be debated in the parliament and so forth. So, you know, they don't need a nuclear weapon. They've got the they've got a nuclear weapon in the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes.
Their nuclear capability.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you about, I don't understand the European mindset. Take Germany, for example. As I see it, and maybe I have a bias because I'm here and I hear this a lot, but it seems to me the Russians deep down, they won't say this, and we'll keep it just between us. I won't let any of my Russian friends hear me say this, but I think deep down the Russians are fascinated by Europeans. They want to be Europeans. Their whole history is kind of Peter the Great and the whole nine. I think deep down, they talk like Europeans. They'd love to be friends with Europe. They'd give anything to be able to have good relationship with Europe. They don't want to attack Europe. And yet, they right now may be the biggest fighting force, and Russia, that is, the most dangerous fighting force in the world. And what does Germany say? That they want to fight Russia, that they're getting ready to go to war with Russia, that they're going to spend a couple $100 billion more on building a 300-person army to be able to defend themselves against Russia. Why? Where does that come from?
Well, Rick, you know a lot about Russian history, but maybe for your viewers, I'll just remind them that for 2.5 centuries, as the West was coming out of the Dark Ages into the Renaissance, Genghis Khan was in charge of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
2.5 centuries, okay? So the Russians have always been sort of playing catch-up ball. Inferiority complex, well, when Peter the Great went to Rotterdam, most people don't know this, he worked incognito for 2 years on the wharves of Rotterdam. You got to see how Western Europe arranges this thing. It goes back when he becomes Tsar. He says, all right, Pushkin has this little poem. Отсюд грозит мы будем шведу, здесь будет город заложен, назмей нас медленно соседу, природа здесь нам суждено, в Европу прорубит окно. Okay, it means, look, from here in Petersburg, we're going to beat a window into Europe. And when the Swedes or the Scandinavians or the Finns threaten us, we're going to beat them back. Yeah. Now, it took them about 3 decades to do that at Poltava, but he did it. Now, did they get rid of their inferiority complex? No. Peter the Great was a little excessive. He tried to beat the serfs into cutting off their beards and not using scythes rather than, you know, sickles and so forth. But, you know, now it's different, and it's just convenient history. Now the Russians have seen what the Europeans are like, and they've seen what they've done in Ukraine.
Yeah.
They've seen how much lying and how distrustful they are.
Yes.
And they have China, which they didn't have before, which China was viewed as an enemy up until, you know, just a couple decades ago. So, you know, they still have an attraction toward Europe. They still want to get along, and the wherewithal is there because Russia has the gas and has the oil, okay?
But it's Europe is kicking them in the teeth. It's like me, Larry, Ray, wanting to be your friend and saying, Ray, call me back. I want to talk to you. Why don't you call me back, Ray? Ray, you don't have to pay me back the loan. Just call me. I want to be friends with you. And you're instead, like, ignoring my calls and crapping on me all over the place. It's almost like what the relationship is like. Why?
Well, that's because of the three blind mice, Macron, Merz, and Starmer. Now, Starmer's on his way out. Macron will be out next year. Merz is about the most unpopular chancellor Germany ever had. So I think the Russians play the long game. You know, they say these guys don't have their own citizens' interests at heart. If Merz wants to spend all this money on making Germany the most powerful army in Europe, oh my God, what happened last time, okay? If he wants to do that, his people are going to rise up because they're used to a pretty decent life with all the social benefits that go with the system they have in Germany. France the same way. Britain is a lost cause. They're never a threat, really. So wait, take your time, see what happens. And Putin actually said that, I'm borrowing from him. He said, look, either by legal parliamentary means or taking it into their own hands, was his phraseology, the Europeans are going to do away with these clowns that they have at the top. And I think he's right about that. I wish we all had the patience that Vladimirovich Putin seems to have.
Yeah. Paciencia, pueblo. You know who used to say that a lot?
Sí, sí, pueblo. Yeah,
Fidel Castro used to say, paciencia, pueblo. In other words, be patient, my people. Everything will work out.
Let me add something here, Rick. Let me add something. You might be able to decipher this here. It says, Putin verstehe, okay? Now, this is a button that I picked up in Germany about 8 years ago. And what it means is, Putin verstehe. Verstehe is the German for understand, okay? So this is somebody who is trying to understand Putin. And I picked that up and said, oh my God, this is great. Can I get one? And my friend said, no, don't do that. I said, why? That puts you, that's a pejorative. If you want to understand Putin, don't wear that thing, Ray, for God's sake.
Oh, I know. My son got married in Europe, and Suzanne and I traveled through Germany. We flew into Frankfurt, and we're all over the place. Germany's beautiful, wonderful experience, gorgeous country. And I would talk to people about Russia, and I'd say, oh, you know, I'm working in Russia. I'm doing some reporting. And, you know, it was like they were shocked. Oh, my God, Russia, that's bad. Putin, it's... Just remarkable that they would respond that way. Hey, final question. I never asked this, but I wanted to ask you because I wanted people to know. When you used to brief the president of the United States, who did you brief, by the way? Who were the presidents that you used to give the daily briefs to?
The first time we CIA briefers got access directly one-on-one to the White House when Ronald Reagan was the nominee, before he even was elected. We insinuated ourselves past the Secret Service, CIA, CIA, and happily, Reagan was coming down for breakfast in his bathrobe, and he said, what's going on here? Will these guys CIA briefer, sir. Come on in. It was terrific. Two of us rotated one day.
Reagan half naked in a room, and you're sitting there going, who the hell are you?
Yeah. CIA. We had these... We had credentials created and so forth, but they weren't buying us, the Secret Service. So it was quite, so when Reagan gets into Washington, he's won, right? And George Bush says, you know, those briefings that you got every morning from the CIA guys, I'd really like to get them too. And yeah, I think the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and, you know, your National Security Advisor, they should get them too. And so what time would you like that to happen? And Reagan says, well, now that we're here, I'll do it every now and then, but I think maybe you get the one-on-one, and then at 11:30, when I'm having half finished breakfast, then maybe you come, the rest of you, and come and brief me as to what I should think about based on what you've been told one-on-one. So I seldom saw Reagan. Every morning, there were two of us, right? So every other morning, two briefers. It would be either the Vice President, Secretary of State Schultz, Secretary of Defense Weinberger. There were an assortment of national security officials that some of them ended up in jail, McFarland, the others. And then we said, look, Mr. President, we'd really like to have the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs included. We think, yeah, sure. So any combination of those, whoever was in town, every other day, I'd see them one-on-one, and it was terrific. It was better than briefing the president because you could get the reaction from all, and we get requirements back. In other words, Weinberger wanted to know something about what was going on in the war between Iraq and Iran. He'd ask us. And the next morning, my colleague, the briefer, would give him the answer. So that whole intelligence cycle, which you know about, in other words, collection, analysis, dissemination, one-on-one, and then collection again based on the requirements given by the briefees. So it was a wonderful experience.
I have to ask you. This just came to mind. This is a dangerous question. I'm going to get in trouble for it or not. But it seems to me that you guys, you spooks, are today, according to my interpretation even of our recent history, led by the nose by a very small country in the Middle East called Israel. I know it's happening now to Mr. Trump, obviously by his actions in Iran. Was it also the case back then? And how did you fight it off, if you did?
Well, it was the case back then. I remember with great regret seeing articles we would pass along to these same people showing the Israeli settlements on the West Bank and in other occupied territories against all the rules of international law, against our prohibitions. They kept doing these things. And you know, I was a Russian specialist, so I didn't get much involved in that except to know what was going on. What I got involved in was trying to appreciate what Gorbachev really, really believed, whether he was the real deal, which my colleagues that I trusted and I believed, or whether he was just a clever commie, which Bobby Gates and his boss, Bill Casey, thought. So Schultz, for example, Secretary of State Schultz, he would say, "Don't worry, I've just been invited to Moscow. Gorbachev wants to see me. I suppose your superiors would think that's a stupid idea." And I go, "What does that mean, Ray?" "That means that I don't always agree with my superiors." He knew damn well.
But Israel, but Israel did have its claws in intel even back then, but maybe not.
Well, yeah, the branch chief on Arab-Israeli relations during 1967, the Six-Day War, told me just 5 years ago, "Look, we knew what happened to the USS Liberty. We knew that the Israelis struck that not only from the air, but with submarine torpedoes. We knew that they wanted to sink it, and it was in our intercepted communications. And if they say those don't exist anymore, that's because NSA and CIA destroyed them." Okay. So, yeah, we knew it. Yeah. We tried to tell. Actually, one little more vignette in the same vein. During the Gulf of Tonkin, okay, I was around then too. I was a Soviet analyst for that part of the world. I went down to the North Korean analyst. I said, "My God, there was no second attack. Oh, man, what does your current intelligence bulletin say for tomorrow?" He says, "Well, we've drafted that, but the head of the Office of Current Intelligence, whom I knew the name, he came down to the fifth floor and he said, 'We're not running that.'" And I said, "Why, sir?" And he said, "Because LBJ has decided to use this to start a war. So we're not telling the truth here, namely that there was no second attack." NSA knew it. They finally knew it in SyncPAC out there in Honolulu. But that's what happens when the political people who have sniffed the wind, that's when they override the analysts. And that happened on Iran, too. Now it's coming out that Trump was fully warned about what a stupid adventure this would be.
Yep.
And we'll see how that comes out.
And he still did it and still trying to convince us that Iran was just this close to having nuclear weapons and he was going to blow us all up the very next day, as a matter of fact. Yes, right. Ray, You are the man. What a delightful conversation. I've learned so much. You've told us so many great stories, and this has really been a fun interview. Let's do it again. I want more stories, okay? So
I got them. Thank you, Rich.
We want them. You got them. What was that, the Burger King ad? Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you once again. God bless.
Okay, you too.
As usual. Wow, what a great conversation, huh? And so real. He just seems so comfortable in his own skin, right? I love people like that. And I thank you for being with us and for allowing us to share these moments with you, these conversations, these reports, this information that we bring to you. Check us out. Share what we do if you want to or if you like what we're doing. And it's okay if you don't. We're on X. We're on Spotify. We're on BitChute. We're actually kind of back on YouTube somehow. I don't know, but suddenly hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people are back watching us on YouTube. They'll probably take us down again. Who the hell knows? I'm Rick Sanchez. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes, and I'll be looking for you next time. Good night.